Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Arnie Luke's here at the Crossroads, and I'd like to welcome my guests from Canada. Welcome, Robert Klink.
Hi, Arnie. Good to
No
see
worries.
you again.
How's the weather?
Our weather has improved. It's now around freezing, and the last 2 days we've had rain and snow off and on.
Okay.
Yesterday we had a very wet snow and flakes an inch and a half across. It was
Wow.
absolutely a delight. Beautiful, beautiful sight. But
Okay.
yeah,
Isn't that wonderful?
we had
That's
some really
lovely.
cold weather recently, but we seem to have come out of it now.
No
For
worries.
the time being.
No worries. Thank you, Robert. And Wally Klink. Welcome, Wally.
Hi there, Arnie. Our weather is unremarkable. It's, I would say, pretty close to the 0 point. It's going to be going above 0 this week, and we haven't had that much snow, and what we have had is substantially sublimated or gone.
Okay, righto, yeah.
And it's quite pleasant actually for this time of year. It's great.
That's excellent.
No
That's
complaints.
excellent. Good, 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 good. Well, our weather is mid-20s. The other day we had
Oh,
an
nice.
inch of rain where we live, which was lovely for summer. And we're heading up to, I think, a top of around 40 by the end of this week. Just gradually up and then back down again. So it's a progressive climb rather than earlier. Earlier in the summer, we actually had changes of 20, 25 degrees from one day to the next, with no, in my view, difficult to understand circumstances. The what is actually going on, where the wind direction appears the same, everything appears the same. We're not bringing the wind across from the desert, and a 25% increase in the weather, and that's a big question mark because for my mind, I couldn't understand the physical reasons why it was going on.
Right.
No doubt the physicists at the bureau could explain it, but I couldn't understand it. Okay, our topic for today, which is a continuation, dialectics and deception. Very important because, in my understanding, dialectics, if you can't think in dialects, in dialectical terms, I understand that. It's not easy to recognize that there is purpose in the discussion or there is purpose in the debate. But if you ever ask yourself, how do policy outcomes affect the individual? And they all seem to be to the negative. And you think this does not make sense until you start thinking in dialectical terms and recognize that there is purpose or design in what's actually going on. Your thoughts, Robert Klink.
Well, dialectics depends on conflict because it's the theory that you advance, and this is an idea that was developed in the material sense by Marx and Engels in the, well, in the mid 19th century. But progress comes through the resolution of conflict. So you have a proposition or a phenomenon, and then its opposite is arises or is taken into consideration, and you combine the two and you come up what they call a what they call come up with what they call a synthesis, and then the synthesis becomes the thesis for the next step in the process. But it's all dependent on a concept of conflict, and it's all dependent too on a fairly narrow assessment of what is happening in the world, because you don't have subtleties of thought. You've got to be on one side or the other of this issue, and so it's something that undermines the mind's ability to see shades of gray, I guess, that sort of thing. But it's also many people talk these days about binary. They say that whenever we're given a choice, the choice is deliberately limited to one of two things.
Okay.
And this is an expression of the dialectic as well.
Yeah.
And you know, it's either this or it's that, but they don't allow for something else.
Yeah.
This, of course, is of interest to social creditors because we believe we have a different point of view and analysis of what's going on in the economy. And therefore, we don't want to be limited to either the socialist or the libertarian options, which is basically what we're allowed to consider. And this this has permeated all our educational institutions and media. It's a terrible phenomenon, and it has done immeasurable damage, I think, to people's ability to think.
No, that's a very good opening descriptor, Robert. I might point out that both libertarianism, liberalism, liberal democracy, and the other forms of collectivism, which is the Marxism, socialism, communism, or fascism, any form of totalitarianism, they're actually yin and yang of collective control of society. I might point that out. And that while the dialectical materialism being the essentially philosophy undergirding most of these points of view, the dialectic is always about centralizing power. It's not actually about coming back to the individual and actually outworking any policy that may affect or benefit the individual personally. Your thoughts, Wally?
Well, it's a complex subject. Certainly the German philosopher Hegel had confined it to the dialectic, to the area of ideas, the world of ideas, so that you would have, opposing ideas, and then you would get a synthesis out of that would be a higher level of understanding. But, excuse me, Marx, of course, was a materialist, and he was looking for some way of combining Hegel's dialectic of conflict of ideas in the material sense, or in the political world, in the world of making things happen. And so that he came up with dialectic materialism, which is actually sowing conflict wherever you can, and using that as a means or as a ground from which to reap benefits in terms of centralizing power or capturing power. And so that's what he adapted it to the political, and he had a theory of the inevitable progress of society. That you would go from one form of production form to another.
I think there's a base on this, and that is man as economic unit, and to me, I don't see man as that at all. But if it's only man as economic unit, of course, when we limit him just to that, and it really is a sad indictment. Keep going, please, Wally.
Well, you see, I mean, the basis of his idea is that there is exploitation, that the worker, relative to the owner, the producer, is at a disadvantage, and that a portion of his effort is literally being stolen by the producer. Now, that was his conclusion, and his object was, of course, to eventually when you're dealing with dialectics, it's a very slippery business, because they use opposites. And we don't tend to, we try to rationalize things, make sense out of things. They use conflict in order to achieve certain ends. And so that when they say something, they can mean something that is totally meaningless to you. You can be at a total disadvantage because you just don't think that way. Most people don't think that. They want to come to some kind of a rational, reasonable conclusion. But you see, in the Marxist approach, it's always conflict that can be, in other words, muddying the water so that you can always derive some benefit from that conflict. So that's what the dialectic materialism of Marxism is all about. And they have, they have an off-putting way of bringing conflict, even alleged conflict, into their own relationships. But it is not done from the standpoint of really deviating from their original purposes. It is done from the standpoint of actually strengthening their position.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's very good. Thank you for that, Wally. When I consider trying to understand politics, trying to understand the outworking of policy, it doesn't have to be just in the economic field, but in any social sphere whatsoever. You're trying to understand it. And unless you can recognize the pattern of the dialectic, then you are disarmed in your understanding of what's actually mm-hmm. transpiring. You think in Australia we have conservative and socialist parties, and you think that they are, one is perhaps more attuned to your way of thinking than the other. But in actual fact, the purpose of the party system, the purpose of these supposed opposites presenting themselves, in the end, is world government. The purpose is consistent. It's just that one will use a certain approach, and that is perhaps it might be world control of governments, and the other may use a different approach, and it is world control of assets, but it is still world control. And that, to me, is very, very important, that you recognize it as it benefits the individual or as it does not benefit the individual. You need to recognize that the pursuit of policy, the outcome is the same. Robert Klink.
Yes, and people also do not have the idea that there is something directed behind this dialectical division of society. There are all sorts of conflicts that have been set up and really artificially created. And if you look at the people who are the theoretical geniuses or the theoretical innovators behind these things, you often find that they are ideological Marxists. Mm-hmm. Examples of these conflicts, one would be feminism, mm-hmm. which has set women against men in society.
That's right.
Another is racism, which gets all sorts of different skin colors angry at each other. Mm-hmm. And you have the libertarian socialist divide.
Mm-hmm. Sexuality.
Yes, now we have that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have Aboriginals being agitated to claim the what they claim they've been deprived of from people who settled in their lands. Mm-hmm. So that's an ongoing conflict too. And mm-hmm. if you look at the people who are being getting the backs of the Aboriginals up, it's usually Marxist agitators again. Mm-hmm. You have ageism. Ageism. They try to create divisions based on age. That's you know, right. The old idea of the generation gap? Well,
that's right. Yeah.
There was something perhaps to that, but I think every generation that comes up is given a new culture, a new music, and it separates them from the previous generation. So there's mm-hmm. a problem of communication there. But this has got so serious now that there is agitation among young people to take away pension benefits, because nowadays it's very hard for people entering the workforce or the work market to qualify for pensions. There are fewer pension benefits than jobs. So old young people are told, look at these older people, they're living the life of Riley, living a wonderful situation that you will never appreciate. Mm-hmm. So maybe you should contemplate taking those advantages that the older people have away, because it's just sure. not fair. Yeah. So this is another artificial divide they've created. Mm-hmm. It's you know, wherever they can split society and create a conflict of interests, whether it's real or not, then they work on this, and they work toward the disintegration of society.
Yeah,
it's a deception, as the title of our discussion says, and it's not accidental.
No, that's right. It's
something that is promoted. Mm-hmm. Somebody comes up with one of these ideas, and all of a sudden it's through all the media and somebody's being lionized as a great innovative thinker. And what they're doing is they are splitting society. Yeah. So in effect, it becomes dysfunctional because people are in conflict with each other.
Yeah.
Surely the ideal would be to have people working harmoniously with each other. But this is not the idea of the dialecticians.
That's right.
They want conflict. They promote it in every conceivable way.
Yeah. And I might add that the most recent conflict, if you like, is the environment, is the climate, global warming. If you can feel it or not feel it, that's one of the reasons why I always bring up the weather, because of the variability of weather across the globe. We are essentially from where Adelaide is to where you two blokes are is the opposite side of the world. You're in the northern hemisphere up, and we're in the southern hemisphere down around the other side of the globe. And what the variability is, man's adaption. And that's what you should be talking about. What we should be talking about is adaption, is actually resolving the difficulties so that we come to a conclusion that suits us. We can't insist, because that's totalitarian, that you accept our conclusion. You have to work through to your own conclusion. Wally Kling.
Well, yes, Artie, what is happening is that it's working to degrade humans. And of course, the materialist doesn't believe in anything but spiritual nature. To the materialist, there is nothing but matter and motion, and that's all. So really, the human being is not, there's nothing especially important about the human being in any kind of a spiritual or continuing sense. It's the human being is expendable, but it's always conflict that is allowing some people to move into the scene and to acquire or to exercise more power over people. Mm-hmm. That's the objective. Mm-hmm. If you remember, if you're going to take a theological approach to it, Jesus was offered control over the nations of the earth. Mm. And he absolutely and flatly rejected that.
That's right.
So you see, and underlying this is a lie. It's the lie of scarcity. Mm. Because, you know, we all have a responsibility and an inclination to survive. Mm-hmm. And if you can convince everyone that that the means of survival is scarce, then of course you can really cause a great deal of dissension and violence and conflict. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is another aspect of this so-called climate change. There is an element of blame in this whole thing, whereas we of our previous way of doing things has been blamed as causing this alleged tremendous threat against humanity. Mm. And there is the idea of selfishness and greed and the allegation of excess experience of life, actually. In other words, they're knocking the standard of life down, and they're using guilt as a major element in the whole process.
Yeah.
Because if you can make people feel guilty, you can very often induce them to do almost anything.
Yeah.
Because they're disarmed. They no longer have self-respect. They know what they lose their ability to move in a constructive manner because they're demoralized. Mm-hmm. And that is part of the whole thing. It's a very complex and it's a very clever thing.
Yeah.
They're very clever. I refuse to grace it with the term of intelligent, mm-hmm. but I will say they're very clever in the derogatory sense.
Yeah. I've seen that recently on one of the forums. We talk about our river systems. It's called the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, mm-hmm. and it's essentially the main irrigation for South Australia and on the eastern states, and it's turning the actual conflict. They're using the manipulation of the situation through media to present one state requirements as overruling another state requirements. And so the conflict is actually between the irrigators of the two states. And of course, it's nothing of the sort. This is an argument that is placed in the forefront because of supposed scarcity. But there is I'll put it to you, there's a dozen potential answers for this problem. All of them really vesting on the belief that why don't we just turn another source of water inland? Because there are, to the north of Australia, vast quantities of fresh water. It flows out to sea. And so it could quite easily be redirected. And there have been plans drawn up of actually redirecting these waters back into the Murray-Darling Basin, which would immediately provide a sufficiency. And so the states wouldn't have the friction, wouldn't have the antagonism. It could easily be resolved. But using the dialectic, the authority, the government departments have no intention of resolving the issue. They want more power in the capital, more power in the capital at the expense of the power being local, administered local, and managed locally. So how does it affect the individual? It disenfranchises the individual, and that is the purpose of the policy. Robert Klink.
Of course, probably the underlying dialectical conflict that is played upon is and exploited is that between the so-called rich and the poor. But again, this is an artificial situation. There's no excuse in our society for anybody to be desperately poor. We're drowning in resources. We can produce much more than we're producing now if we wanted to, and we're already probably producing pretty much an adequacy for the population. So this is a fundamental division that has been exploited ever since Marx's day. He was the one who said, workers of the world, unite and throw off the chains of your oppression and all this stuff. And that was based on the separation between the rich and the poor. Now, the founder of social credit, C.H. Douglas, cast this situation in a new light when he said, if we're fighting about who is going to have the resources of the world, it's no more intelligent than fighting over a cup of water in the middle of Lake Superior. I guess you know what Lake Superior is, the biggest lake in the world, because right. we've got all this wealth.
Yeah.
So, but they keep people in a state of artificial scarcity so that they are fighting for their share of it. Mm-hmm. And this is simply because their share in it is not recognized by the people who run our current financial system. If you look at the progress of productive means, they have multiplied probably thousands of times over in the last couple of centuries, and yet basically people are not advanced significantly in the way they live their lives and in the amount of personal freedom they have even. Mm-hmm. So that is one thing. There was a professor, a social credit professor, Jeffrey Dobbs. Mm-hmm. And nowadays we hear about cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. And cognitive dissonance is the inclusion in one proposition, say, of conflicting ideas. Mm-hmm. And the mind is exposed to this, and sort of unconsciously, it can't resolve the conflict, and therefore it is essentially paralyzed and rendered incapable of functioning. Mm-hmm. And Jeffrey Dobbs came up with a description of an aspect of this. He called it the technique of the essential adjective. And it was very interesting, and it's something that you will find Marxists using. Mm-hmm. And what it consists of, combining two words, but the combination implies a logical impossibility. An example of it would be, for example, participatory democracy. Well, democracy means rule by the people. So if you have something called participatory democracy, that implies that there is something that is non-participatory democracy, which how can that be if it's ruled by the people? It's an impossibility, but it creates a conflict in the mind. Another one that just came up here recently in our province is job action. Mm-hmm. Now, job action is when people are going on strike. I don't know if that's true in your part of the world or not, but job action is when the people with jobs stop acting. Mm-hmm. You know, if that's silly. Yeah. They don't say you have job action when they're doing their jobs well. They say you have job action when they're on strike and refusing to work. Another interesting one that Jeffrey Dobbs drew attention to back in the 60s, I guess, was free love. And he said that the word love derives from a Middle English word called the Middle English word leaf, and it meant love. So in effect, they're saying that that free love would mean a category of love that is not free. But love in its essence is free. And this was recognized in, I guess, Middle English in this term leaf. They would say, I leaf would do something. My loving disposition leads me to do something. Mm-hmm. So he was drawing attention to the fact that it's an undermining of the meaning of the word love to associate it with the word free and suggest that there's another category of love that is unfree, because love in its essence is free. But very interesting observations he made. And that's, you keep your eye out for these terms, because they are used quite consciously, quite intentionally, by people who want to render us incapable of clear thought.
Very, very important. I'm going to cut across to our website here, our library, and under religation, which is right here, there's Jeffrey Dobbs and religation, and it's in the discipline of that particular document that Jeffrey Dobbs actually deals with the essential adjective. There may be other references to it, but the search engine that I just punched it into just showed me that that is where Jeffrey is writing about it under religation. You can print that PDF out locally and read it at your leisure. We're at the nearly 28 minute mark, Wally. I'm just going to give you a heads up, and Wally Klink.
Well, yes, I think we have to understand basically that we live in a world that is artificially in conflict. If you look at the natural world, things in nature do not have political parties. They don't debate policies. They're not in conflict all the time. They have to be in conflict to the extent that they must live in a state, perhaps of some scarcity, that they may exist. But the thing of it is, it's not a natural thing. We live in what is an artificial dichotomy, a dialectic. It's a dichotomy, an opposing of opposites, which is really an abnormal state for us to be in. What we seek is a functional world. Mm-hmm. A functional world. Now, that's the social credit approach. And so that we should be able to cooperate in a state of democracy, but not democracy in the sense of mob action or political parties. I mean, the thing of it is, in our lives, we should be able to have maximum freedom of action, freedom of association, freedom to enter into association or to exit from association, depending upon the quality of the results that we get from that association. Whereas today, so many questions are made on the basis of mass decisions, where it's virtually impossible to come to an overall agreement, that we spend a lot of our time, much of our time, just literally expending energy without really getting anywhere.
That's right.
So I would say that we have, and as far as love is concerned, for a Christian at least, it is the essence of the universe. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. Yeah. It's not conflict. There's a canon, and if you have an affinity or an awareness of the canon or some kind of an attachment to it or an awareness, you are going to behave in a manner that is loving and that is conducive to constructive relationships.
Yeah.
So it's a totally different approach. And the financial system at the apex of all of this is really behind this conflict, because the financial system gives us a minimized or a minimal reflection of reality. It minimizes the picture of reality to make us think that we're living in a state of actual physical inadequacy a lack and scarcity. And so that this causes a whole basis of conflict to emerge to the forefront, and it begins to dominate our lives, as you'll see in the United States now. They spent a couple of years fighting and not doing much of anything, I don't think, to really improve this. It's certainly not their image anyway. I mean, it's just bizarre. It's uncivilized. It's it's really a disgrace.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that this financial system is the key to the problem, because if the financial system were altered in such a way that gave a proper representation of the amazing wealth that you mentioned that we actually do have access to, or to which we have access, then we would see the reality that where there is no scarcity. And the reality is also that we could have far, far more than we even have because of increased efficiencies and so on, and an ability to derive more benefit from activity than we did previously, you know, through new technology and so on.
Yeah.
And so and the financial system thereby is, therefore, is the source of most conflict, because it is misrepresenting reality and putting us all in an artificial conflict with amongst each other.
That's right. And the thing is that the mainstream media, all the media outlets presenting this dialectic to us as the only news in town, are asking us to choose between one of two things. Whereas in the form of natural opposites, if you like, government being power and freedom being the people, held in equilibrium is limiting the power of government, limited monarchy, limited republic, limited government. It holds it in equilibrium, even though they may be opposites. And so when you look at capital and you look at labor, they may appear to be antagonistic, but with Douglas social credit, economic democracy places both under discipline and brings labor into, or the individual, if you like, into correct relationship with capital, so that they can exercise their freedom, at the same time allowing capital to make a profit, which they're entitled to.
Robert, yes, please. And I argue we all really have a beneficial interest in association. We should not be at cross purposes.
Yeah, capital and labor have a common interest. If the system was working properly, they would be benefiting, both of them, by that proper functioning.
Yeah.
But there's a, it's putting a spike in our spokes all the time and not letting us get what we want. So, in effect, with this dialectical sabotage going on all the time, there is never peace. And the idea of it is to wear us down to the point where we just become apathetic and so discouraged that we are ineffective as individuals.
Capitulate.
And that's why all these artificial conflicts are constantly being thrown up and encouraged, whereas, our proper goal should be mutual benefit and peaceful relations and harmony.
Yeah.
But you'll never have those if you have people making trouble who are trained in dialectical thought.
That's right. And that, to me, is the key to today's forum, is it attempting to paint a picture that will help you as our listeners, as our viewers, understand this dialectical methodology. It's so very, very important to come to grips with. Closing thoughts, please, Wally.
Well, yes, I social credit actually identifies the problem in the economy, not between capital and labor, or between elements of that, any kind like that. It actually identifies the problem as a failure at the consumption end of the economic cycle. Marx identified it within the cycle, but social credit identifies the problem basically as a blockage, sort of a cost of narrowing, a blockage of the flow, the free flow of the wealth that emanates from human association to society. You see, the present system gathers wealth and power. It does it in the term of debt, primarily, mm-hmm. in different forms. And now that social credit wants to eliminate that debt and to spread its benefits to the population at large. Shall we say that the poor shall inherit the earth, or the meek shall inherit the earth? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the purpose of production is consumption. If you block consumption, you're frustrating consumption or production itself. The producer will perform far better if there is consumption, because he needs consumption as an outlet for his efforts and to recover his financial costs, of course. Mm-hmm. So that if you correct the deficiency of purchasing power, you're going to benefit production in the sense that production will more readily respond to the freely expressed desires of the consuming public, mm-hmm. as individuals, as they spend their money in a sense of voting with it for the results that they want, and that they will use to reward the producer for giving those results. If the producer does not give a desired result, then the consumer will withdraw that support, then the producer will be disciplined automatically, mm-hmm. in order to alter his product or his service to make it satisfactory if he wishes to remain in business. Mm. But again, we shouldn't be in a position where we would not regard economics as the sole end of life. We want to release mankind. We don't want full employment. We want to release mankind, mm-hmm. so that men and women are free to be human beings in their own right and to explore the universe of ideas and the physical universe and the social universe freely to their mutual advantage.
Yeah, beautifully put, Wally. Beautifully, beautifully put. The purpose of the policy is to free the individual. Closing thoughts, Robert Plink.
Well, Wally was talking about the problem at the consumption end in the economy. That is basically in the distribution function of the economy. Mm-hmm. And we are always provided with a solution to this at the productive end of the economy.
That's right.
The problem is in distribution, but in order to deal with that problem, we are told we have to increase production. Well, that is putting us in, I guess, a dialectical conflict again. And yeah. It's totally illogical. That's Why right. not tackle the problem where it is? They take it one remove away and they give us this impossible task of solving our distributive problems through more production. It's mm-hmm. it's a very clever way of keeping control over us, I guess.
Exactly.
But it's just illogical. Mm.
I have really enjoyed today, gentlemen. 39-minute mark. We've done really well, but the thing is, we've explored a deep thought, dialectics and deception. And no doubt there'll be an opportunity in the weeks ahead to continue this thinking and this investigation of what is actually happening with us and with our thinking. Thank you so, so much, Robert and Wally Clink, Canada.
Thank you, Annie.
No worries. Cheers, then.